I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we say, with global attitude. This one is about the temptation to war in Afghanistan, the place, as Glenn Lowry put it to us not long ago, where empires ever since Alexander the Great go to die, or the place where President Obama and his fact-finding mission may be considering other possibilities. We're in conversation in New York with Parag Khanna, Indian-born, American-educated, early 30s, an independent writer with a U.S. passport, well-known now for his motorbike travels in what he calls the Second World, countries on the verge of something, Brazil, Vietnam, Turkey, Morocco, many more, countries that look more and more to China and Europe for means and models of how to globalize. Parag Khanna was just back from Pakistan last week when I asked him to take apart the anxiety in the air around Afghanistan. Parag Khanna of the book The Second World, you're my candidate to decode the panic about Afghanistan. Afghanistan falling to the Taliban, Pakistan falling apart, Barack Obama and his presidency falling toward his Vietnam. What's the real fear, in your view, just back from South Central Asia?
But the military has had this panic for a long time. You've all already read many accounts of how military officers in Afghanistan have said, we would have been able to go after the Taliban, go after Al-Qaeda, conduct certain strikes, but no, the assets, the drones, the technology, the satellites were taken away and sent to Iraq. So the military has expressed serious concern about what is happening right now, happening several years in the making. So we know that we almost knew this was coming, but we're paying attention to it now because we're moving the troops over. Obviously, Obama never wanted this to have to happen. You know, he campaigned on this platform of taking a stronger or focusing more on Afghanistan, and now he has no choice because it's become so insecure. So you know, all of these things sort of flow together.
Not so fast. What do you mean he has no choice? This was the line about Iraq. It's now inevitable. We have to go forward. What does he have to do?
Well, politically, he has to do this because he said this is what he's going to do. I try not to make my strategic decisions and commitments based on logic of political campaigning. But this is it's a very intrinsically American reaction to the situation. Every problem still looks like a nail when all we're using is the hammer. And Obama has, no doubt, fallen into that trap. It is not clear that we know exactly what we're going to be doing with these extra 17 to 20 or perhaps 25 or perhaps 30,000 troops eventually. The proof of that, just look no further than Europe, where they've asked many times, what are you going to do with all these troops? And they haven't gotten a solid answer. So that tells you something. I will say this. I think that there are two priorities at the moment. One is to protect Kabul effectively from falling. We've had an uptick in attacks in the city. And if the capital falls, that is obviously a very significant loss. And then secondly, to stabilize enough of the country so that these elections can take place later this year. The third element of the strategy, honestly, is just to pray. That's really what's going on. This is a three-part strategy. And we will see in 6 months' time if they've accomplished the first two objectives. If they have, then they can try and be a bit more ambitious when it comes to reconstruction. Because right now, the stabilization they have in mind is a very short-term stabilization, instrumental towards the goal of holding an election, and not really much more than that.
Parag, you write from the region that the diplomatic military surge is on. Which is it, diplomatic or military?
It's most certainly both. Ambassador Holbrook has just returned from a two-week trip through the region, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. He is bringing the Afghanistan and Pakistani delegations to Washington next week, in fact, to work on some cross-border initiatives related to border control, reconstruction, stabilization, tribal development. All these kinds of things are going on. That is most definitely diplomacy, very active, vigorous, proactive diplomacy. So it's taking place. Whether or not it will succeed, we don't know. We have had cross-border jirgas between Afghanistan and Pakistan before. We've had joint border monitoring posts. We've even had joint counter-terrorist operations. None of it is, it's not amounted to much, especially during the Musharraf era. We can hope that things will be different since Karzai and Zardari have a decent relationship, but we can't really be confident that Zardari is going to last all that long. So there's always one shaky leg, if not two shaky legs, of this stool. But definitely there is intense diplomacy going on, and of course there's the military side. It's better than nothing.
Parag, you write in Foreign Policy magazine, I have seen the incoherency with my own eyes. What does that mean?
Well, the incoherency, it relates very specifically to the problem of managing both Afghanistan and Pakistan at the same time. The trouble with the troop surge into Afghanistan is that if it simply forces a retreat of the Taliban back over the border into Pakistan, that destabilizes an already very volatile situation in the tribal areas of Pakistan. I liken it to squeezing a balloon on one side and it then just inflates on the other. And that other side is Pakistan, a much larger, ultimately much more strategic and an important country, one with nuclear weapons, one that's also a sort of rival client state of China's, and all of these dynamics going on in Pakistan that are very great game-esque. And I certainly worry that that there are not two sides, there are not equal and opposite Afghan and Pak strategies going on right now. That, to me, is the ultimate strategic incoherence.
Spell that out.
There are not two equally strong geographic approaches to the region in between Afghanistan and Pakistan. There's an Afghan strategy, which we've been talking about, military and otherwise. But where is the similar strategy that's needed on the Pakistani side to keep what's happening in Afghanistan from just spilling over and really pushing Pakistan over the edge? You already have Taliban elements and groups and allied factions taking over the Swat Valley, which is so close to Islamabad. You already have a strong loyalty to the Tehrik-i-Taliban Pakistan, the TTP in South Waziristan. You have Peshawar, which is an extremely fragile situation at the moment, a city of several million people where the Taliban do roam freely and local citizens are intimidated. They're fleeing their homes and leaving them abandoned, trying to sell them but unable to. So that's a very, very vulnerable mix at the moment. And at the exact time that that's happening and that the Pakistani government has been extremely slow to work on developing and integrating that region, you're just, not 100 miles away pushing the Taliban into that mix.
Parag Khanna, can you dope out what the Barack Obama hope is, the plan, and what is the assignment for Richard Holbrooke?
That's exactly what he's going to determine now that he's returned. You know, they went on a so-called listening tour, just like Hillary Clinton did in Asia simultaneously, try and hear what everyone wants to do, and then decide what are their two or three priorities going to be, given all of the problems that exist in the region. Are they going to dump Hamid Karzai and work on supporting someone else? Are they going to try and change the very structure of the Afghan state from a presidential one to a parliamentary style one and shift someone else or move him into the prime minister's role? And it seems to me that one of their priorities is most certainly just managing an election in Afghanistan, although they haven't yet decided what they want the outcome to be. Second priority is most definitely going to be coordinated border stabilization between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that's why these two delegations are coming to Washington next week. What can they do to fight the Taliban on both sides, if anything, and what economic reconstruction projects can they undertake? I would say that's the second, equally important priority for them. I would say that those two issues alone are going to consume most of Holbrooke's time.
Would you explain to me, the layman, this sudden deflation of Hamid Karzai? I mean, the tide has gone out. He's fair game for anybody. Suddenly, there's corruption in Afghanistan. I'm shocked. Joe Biden is shocked. He's leaving the meeting. And our media suddenly falls into place. What is this about?
This is most definitely a dirty little game that's being played. Everyone knows that Afghanistan is extraordinarily corrupt. We have contributed to some extent to the corruption because we have been going out and bribing all sorts of individuals to maintain their loyalty to Karzai. And yet we're sort of, hitting it. Everyone needs a scapegoat, basically. And he's become our scapegoat, even though he's our appointed leader. He's very much been our SOB, so to speak, even though he's not a thug as such. So what I worry about, though, it's not so easy to simply uninstall someone. The train has left the station in some ways. We have built a loyal security service to him. We have built a national army that respects him. What do you do with those elements? And what happens if you do turn against Karzai and he decides he doesn't want to play ball with simply being ousted? So you could lead to some very ugly dissension within what is supposed to be a friendship and a partnership and an alliance. So I think that whether it's Joe Biden or Obama, They need to be very careful about simply treating him like yesterday's news and throwing him out with the trash. That would not be smart.
It's another one of those symptoms that makes people worry about Vietnam. I mean, he's getting the Diem treatment.
Right.
Suddenly, I mean, you're the reason we're there, but suddenly you're expendable.
Well, it didn't go so well in Vietnam when we did away with or simply parted ways with our sort of local ally. And he is most certainly our strongest local ally to decentralize the country, which might be more in line with Afghanistan's tribal and fragmented history and tribal structure. So in the longer run, sure, a fragmented Afghan state is perhaps the ideal outcome. But right now, if the goal is to have a strong national army that is going to help the United States stabilize the country in order to have elections, in order to fight the Taliban, in order to stem the flow of drugs, in order to be able to capture Al-Qaeda and its affiliates in that region, if those are your goals, which are America's goals, you actually do need a fairly strong center. Who is that going to be besides Karzai at the moment? And that's just a sort of, you know, objective assessment of it, irrespective of whether you like or dislike Karzai.
Parakana, I read your argument that we should be going regional in Afghanistan, and it seems to make every kind of sense. Let the neighbors work it out in a fashion. Afghanistan, for most Americans, is still sort of Kipling's back of beyond. It's almost to the moon as far as strangeness is concerned. But that means making a new common cause around Afghanistan with Iran, with China, with Russia perhaps, with Pakistan for sure, and India.
That's right.
What's difficult about that assignment, to work on the neighborhood?
Well, it's inherently difficult geographically for the United States to deal with it any other way. We've been in geographic denial because we've had a constant military presence in Afghanistan since 9/11. But the truth is that we have no border with landlocked Central Asia. We do, in fact, require as many local regional allies as possible. If you look around the world at security institutions, you find that the two regions that don't have them are the ones that are the most insecure. One is South Central Asia, and the other is the Persian Gulf region. If we're not contributing to building those longer-term, institutionalized architectures, then we're not really creating a long-term solution. We're just simply perpetuating our own role over there, which fewer and fewer countries want. See the news, of course, with the case of the Kyrgyzstan closing down the Manas airbase, and several years ago, Uzbekistan closing the K2 airbase. Our presence over in the region militarily has always been extremely vulnerable to this sort of political pressure from neighboring countries. We have contributed very little to an integrated regional security framework for the region, which involves India, Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, China, Russia, Uzbekistan, and others. But that is exactly what needs to happen in the long run for the region to be responsible for its own security and for us not to be stuck over there for decades to come. Now, hopefully, we'll do that. I think that necessity can be the mother of genius. The supply lines in Pakistan have been heavily attacked by Taliban forces. It's been at risk. The U.S. is scrambling for alternatives. One of those alternatives could be Iran. If so, that opens up an opportunity to engage Iran in Afghan stabilization. The Obama administration has said that it will talk to Iran on counter-narcotics issues, but it could certainly also talk to them about logistics and supply. Other NATO countries are most certainly going to do that right now, that NATO has given the green light for it. Maybe the United States should as well.
What is the Chinese piece of this puzzle?
I think China plays a very important role here. China tends to hang back or pull back in any region where the United States has surged its presence and then just wait it out. This is actually no different. But at the same time, under the radar, China is the largest foreign investor in Afghanistan, increasingly in Pakistan as well. It borders both countries. It is building roads and ports in Pakistan as well as in Afghanistan. It's building a road across the northern part of the country. So it has a long-term commercial and strategic interest in being able to transit safely across Afghanistan and Pakistan. So it's certainly hoping that the U.S. doesn't make the situation even worse in the short to medium term. I also believe that because Iran and Pakistan and Afghanistan, all three of them, will become members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization soon, that this SCO group could be a mechanism to provide peacekeeping stabilization forces or provincial reconstruction team elements to actually conduct some reconstruction, humanitarian, security sort of work in Afghanistan.
Introduce the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was started by China in the mid-1990s, and the goal was to counter what was to join forces with the former Soviet Central Asian republics as well as Russia in to settle the borders that were not properly demarcated with the collapse of the Soviet Union, to focus on counter-drug operations and counter-terrorism operations. The Chinese were worried about the Uyghur population of Western China and their potential links to the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, the IMU, and other terrorist groups. So that was one of the motivations. Then they also worked on commercial and cultural relations and just sort of facilitating trade among all the countries. China started giving significant amounts of export credits and building infrastructure in these countries to facilitate its own exports in the region. So it's grown into something that some consider to be a potential alliance. Some call it the NATO of the East. It's not quite that far advanced yet, but one sees that when they do coordinate their activities, they can either do a lot of good or cause a lot of trouble. They can do a lot of good because there have been significant counterterrorism activities together, border monitoring, customs, and other sorts of facilitation that have happened among SCO countries. They've built a lot of trust. On the other hand, they've also banded together to close now not one but two U.S. bases that are in Central Asia, which really hampers Western operations. So the SCO is clearly a very important player that NATO has had very little dialogue with in Afghanistan itself. SCO officials have been in Brussels and have tried to learn from NATO procedures and protocols and methods of building an alliance, and NATO has been all too gracious in complying. But they haven't cooperated in Afghanistan, and I feel that they should and that they could, and this will help avert a kind of, you know, East versus West rivalry in Central Asia.
What we hear about the Obama administration and Afghanistan is mostly numbers and its troops. 17,000 committed, on the way to 30,000 more perhaps. What are we not hearing about the Chinese angles, the Iranian angles, the Indian angles in the Obama planning?
Well, we are in crisis management mode, which is why you're hearing a lot of reactive, big number kind of stuff that is sort of band-aid geopolitics, which is kind of what's going on. On the other hand, there is clearly a movement towards talking to Iran on the drug issue and on logistics and supply. That's a good start in a very short amount of time. So it's good to see that is underway, but it doesn't amount to a grand regional strategy yet. Hopefully that can be built from the bottom up. What we obviously need to hear a lot more about, and Obama has started to articulate it, and Holbrooke has as well, but that's how much money needs to go into development assistance, not just into the military commitment. So here we're talking about not just the $10 billion that has gone to military reimbursements to the Pakistani army, but the $10 billion that's needed over the next 5 to 7 years for economic reconstruction and investment in the Northwest Frontier Province and the Fatah region, and the focus on the constitutional reforms within Pakistan that will help integrate those regions. That's what we're starting to hear a little bit more about, but we have not scratched the surface in trying to understand how we're going to spend that money, how to avoid it being siphoned off by corrupt ministries, how to get that money into insecure regions to actually stimulate development and stabilization and job creation for Pashtun people. This is why I have argued that we need to have provincial reconstruction teams within Pakistan, but led by Pakistani civilian agencies with American funding and some rear support. But the Pakistani government doesn't have their act together on that, and we haven't done enough to help them. We've only been focusing on the military.
Where are we in Pakistan and Afghanistan at the end of 2009?
So about 1 year from now, I can imagine that things are, at best, a little bit better than they are right now. I can imagine that the Afghan election would have taken place. There would have been a decent amount of participation. The Taliban may have pulled back simply in order to allow it to happen because they clearly hold the upper hand. They know where to hide for months at a time in order to stay out of our way if they want to. But they will have, if there is a consensus as to Afghan leadership, there could be a certain amount of political stability that doesn't feel like it's there right now. It could be under Karzai. It could be under someone else. So that's an optimistic scenario for 1 year from now. Optimistically, another year from now on the Pakistani side, the military will have pushed back a bit against the Taliban and started to take more control over some of the tribal agencies such as Peshawar through supporting local militias and working with them against the Taliban. They will have maybe reclaimed the Swat Valley, which they've just sort of signed off to certain elements of the Taliban. So they're going to have to grow a lot more confidence and willpower and start to push back. But one senses, having just been in Pakistan myself, that the awakening is happening because they realize even Islamabad, even Lahore aren't necessarily safe anymore. So that the crisis that they're feeling could inspire them to get their act together.
Parag Khanna, you hooked me a year ago in the New York Times Magazine and in your book, Second World, with a view of the United States coming off the unipolar hyperpower moment, coming off the imperial high. Your broad view, if I got it right, was that there are now three ways for the developing world to globalize, to make it economically, culturally, politically. There's China's way, there's Europe's way, and there's our way. And that our way, after 6-7 years of the Iraq War, is limping big time. In 2009, what's new, A, after the Obama election, and B, in this now maybe comprehensive world depression?
There are definitely two separate factors that are weighing on the kind of geopolitical dynamics. I have to say that our election at the end of the day is something of a blip, in the sense that geopolitical dynamics and power transitions that are well underway will continue to be. China's rise owes itself to the Deng Xiaoping era reforms, not to who was American president at any given time. China's rise, in other words, continues. Its ambition continues. Its outreach around the world for resources and for allies continues. So it is seeking influence, and it will continue to no matter who the United States president is. Hillary Clinton was just in China, in fact. It doesn't seem to have changed much in the relationship. Of course, you know, Russia is still going to muscle around its neighbors based on its own either internal political decision-making or based on oil prices. Again, that has very little to do with who the president of the United States is. So in a lot of ways, Iran is going to continue to seek a nuclear weapon, no matter who the president of the United States is. And even if we do reach out to them, they may still have a nuclear program. So in many, many ways, our election does not change the unfolding power dynamics, the rise of second world powers, their autonomous decision-making, their quest for security on their own terms. These are things inherent in the system today that America can either contribute to, but it can't stop or change them. So I would say a far more systemic factor than our election is actually this global financial crisis. And what this does is, at the end of the day, still advance the notion that there is a devolution of power away from the United States. And the reason for that is that even though the rest of the world has been hurt by the quote-unquote Made in America financial crisis, that doesn't mean that America is going to be the least affected or that America has the best prescription for getting its getting back on its feet again. In fact, what we see is that there's really going to be a race to rebound. And most investors around the world or financial analysts and others aren't betting that America is going to be the first to recover from this crisis. Chinese and Indian growth rates are still high. Persian Gulf governments could get their act together again. The global pool of capital that's in the Chinese and other central banks and through foreign exchange reserves is potentially going to find other homes in the coming years because there may not be a lot of confidence in America's stimulus package and so forth. So I believe that this presents an opportunity that is likely to accelerate the devolution of power away from the United States, to accelerate the investment within the second world rather than money flowing from the developing world into the United States. It will flow across the second world, and you will find that other areas may rebound faster than the United States. So when all is said and done, this will be a crisis that will really hurt America's position, even as emerging markets are currently hurting as well.
You say that without qualification. I wonder, I would have thought that the rise of Barack Obama was, in effect, your kind of tonic for the American distress, rejoining the world, not only with a broader human empathy, but with much less emphasis on unilateral military remedies. Has Barack Obama read your book? Do you feel some kinship between your arguments and his politics?
Barack Obama most certainly understands that this is a more diffuse world, that the United States cannot unilaterally call the shots militarily or diplomatically. Take the financial crisis, things aren't being done the way America doesn't know what it's doing anyway. So people are looking to Gordon Brown or elsewhere or to the Chinese Central Bank for solutions. Then take Iran. The U.S. is going to be adopting the European view of engagement and dialogue and these sorts of things. Take North Korea, where the same thing is going to be happening as well. So it's not so much that American leadership is being restored or that America is going back to the world or rejoining the world as such. It may do those things, but we have to evaluate to what extent there even is an international order for America to rejoin. I believe that that international order is in some form of decay because these rising powers are doing things their own way. Russia is not consulting with the United Nations when it invades Georgia. You know, China is not consulting any UN Human Rights Committee when it rolls tanks into Tibet. So, you know, things are going on that really speak against the notion of a strong central international community. Clearly, Obama has said that the UN is going to be a priority. He's made the ambassador to the United Nations a cabinet-level position. That doesn't mean that the United Nations will suddenly be a more effective organization either. The National Intelligence Council's 2025 report says that by that point, 10-15 years from now, there won't even really be any such thing as the international community. It was a very striking argument for them to be making. They're pointing to a very medieval sort of future rather than one in which international institutions can, in fact, direct and order global affairs the way we thought they could in the aftermath of the Cold War.
Last question. Set the military and the financial matters aside for one moment. Politically and culturally, where are we in 2009, in the Obama presidency, in the world?
I think that there is certainly optimism. I think they are sending the right signals of cooperation around the world to any number of countries, and that has been welcome. So in the diplomatic atmospherics of this, the Obama administration is doing pretty well. Obviously, he's only just begun his foreign travels. He's gone to Canada. He's obviously going to be taking some other trips soon. I think that there is going to be an atmosphere of collegiality around the world and a focus on problem-solving rather than on politics and personalities. That alone is an accomplishment when compared with what we've had for the last 8 years. But when it comes to who has the best ideas, who has the money and the resources to put on the table, who has the expertise, and who has the organizational design to solve some problems, there I don't really find that the United States holds the solution in any single area. Not in the global financial crisis does the United States have the right roadmap for the world. We are, in fact, learning state capitalism from Europe now, just to take one example. On Iran, the U.S. does not have the solution. The U.S. is not an expert in building regional internally regional security architectures. Other countries have better relations with Syria and with Iran and the key players in that region than we do at this point. So it's going to have to be collaborative. It's not a made in America solution. Same thing goes for Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the U.S. is clearly in the driver's seat, but hasn't decided what exactly it's going to do. Then there's reform of the major global financial institutions, where the U.S. has disproportionate share of seats and votes along with Europeans, but they can't agree on how they're going to handle it. And then come back to the economy again. The United States goes protectionist. There'll be a far less amount of trust in the U.S. For economic leadership as well. So we find in issue after issue the feel-good notion that with a new administration we're going to be in the driver's seat really doesn't stand up to scrutiny.
Parag Khanna, you're a hard marker. That's a tough report card, but it's always a pleasure, a bracing dose of realism, to read you and to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Parag Khanna with help from our Brown undergraduate intern, Hannah Olson. Please post your own two bits on Obama Nation looking at the world and Afghanistan in particular. Write it in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org, and we'll keep the conversation going. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining in.